Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative, and United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org. New York State Assembly Speaker Carl Hastie threw cold water on a bill this week that would require major energy companies to pay for climate change remediation, saying the measure would ultimately result in higher costs for utility ratepayers. The Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt reports.
The Climate Change Superfund Act would require companies that contributed significantly to the buildup of greenhouse gases to pay for part of the mitigation efforts to offset climate change, including major infrastructure projects like water barriers. The measure was approved in the state Senate, but it stalled in the Assembly. Speaker Carl Hastie says he's concerned that it would result in higher utility prices, as the energy companies would pass down the costs of the new requirements to ratepayers.
I've never in my life seen corporations choose the ratepayer over the stockholder. So, you know, asking these companies to pay more, it's going to be, of course, taken out on the ratepayer.
Other environmental bills under consideration in the final days of the session include the New York Heat Act. It would ban gas companies from charging ratepayers for new gas line hookups and a requirement that plastics packaging be reduced by 50% in the coming years. Hastie says he's talking with the Senate and Governor Kathy Hochul's staff to try to reach an agreement. The Senate is said to be considering a change that would require just a 30% reduction in plastic packaging. Hastie says the Assembly hasn't agreed to that, though discussions continue. But the speaker says it's likely that some environmentally friendly measures will be approved.
We do want to do some environmental things.
The session is scheduled to end June 7th.
That was the Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt, who is about to retire after 34 years as the Capitol Bureau Chief and correspondent for the New York Public News Network. I spent some time with Karen this week talking about her career and perspective on New York State government and politics. But I began by asking her how she arrived at her current position.
When I got out of college, very, very long time ago, I worked at some commercial stations around here, which, by the way, is excellent training. I know you come from commercial radio immediately. You just have to get up and perform all the time when you're doing commercial radio. And, you know, I was attracted to the Capitol. Those were the days of Mario Cuomo, the Assembly Speaker Stanley Fink. I think that Ed Koch was mayor of New York City then and would come up to Albany. And it just seemed like this cool place with larger-than-life people. Mario Cuomo was a national figure, and I was always interested in politics. And you know what? I couldn't get in the front door, so I got in the back door. A stringer job opened for 1010 Winds, the powerhouse all-news station. And I took that job and started writing for magazines, including Metroland, if people listening probably remember Metroland, Adirondack Life.
What about the Knickerbocker News?
I never wrote for the Knickerbocker News, but they were certainly influential in the day. Everybody read them when they came out at 2 p.m. in the afternoon, right? And in 1990, the public radio job opened. Someone else had started the bureau. It was only 2 years old. We had four stations. I don't think WAMC was even one of them then. I think it was WXXI in Rochester, where I had had an internship in college, and Buffalo, Binghamton, and WMHT, who did news in those days. WAMC joined a couple years later, and we just built it to like 10 stations, and I don't even know how. It's all a blur, David. You know, you ask me to do a retrospective on my work, and you know, the thing about doing certainly the daily news beat, especially on radio, it's very ephemeral. You just get up every day and you do it.
It's here and gone. And yet,
right,
something came along midway, maybe halfway, I don't know where you want to put it in our career, because I can't even remember that far back. The internet came in, and that changed everything for journalism.
That's right. In some ways, the politicians could get around us, so that's changed. We have less access. And actually, we have all, as journalists, had to work a lot harder.
We have to know how to spell.
We have to work with video now. Right. I did forget how to spell for about 20 years because it was all on the radio.
But why journalism for you, Karen? Is it because you had an interest in politics? What was it that drew you to this field?
Well, I guess I would have to say, why not? Because I actually never wanted to do anything else. It's been the easiest decision in my whole life. We had a television station at our high school, Burnt Hills Ballston Lake High School, with a great late Dan DiNicola, who was our teacher, very inspirational person. There's a lot of people in media in this area still because of his influence. And, you know, I was a classic underachiever high school kid, and that sparked an interest. And I really didn't like to do anything else. I would say I'm not really suited to do anything else in this life. So it's just been very easy, and I had the drive. I liked it. I wanted to do it. I showed up every day and just tried my hardest and somehow got through and ended up having a wonderful job for 3 decades.
And you joined the Capitol Bureau at a time when you were one of the only women.
That's right. The Legislative Correspondents Association, the LCA, has really changed a lot. When I was there, there'd be most years maybe 2 or 3 women at the most. Sometimes I'd be the only one. It was really a man's world and really mostly a white male, middle-aged at that time. It seemed that way to me, world. But, you know, you adapt. Honestly, I liked working with the guys. Nobody gets into too much personal business at work. They would mostly sit around and just make fun of the politicians. Like, everything's a little bit sarcastic, a bit cynical. So I don't know. That certainly shaped my personality. Well, but these days, there's a lot of women, a lot of young women who are doing it. And it's changed the culture, and it's great, actually.
Politics and media have a similar kind of culture in a way.
Right.
Rough and tumble, maybe a little desensitized to a lot of the issues that we cover, which can be terrible and horrific. And,
well, you kind of have to at times.
Yeah.
You know, you really can't bring stuff home. Though that said, there have been times and things that I've covered where I do wake up at 3 a.m. and say, oh my God, did that really happen yesterday? You know?
Well, let's talk about one of those moments for a moment. I mean, you had a governor in Eliot Spitzer described as a white horse coming in at the time that he came in. He wanted to clean up Albany. And then one day you're rubbing your eyes and there's a headline in the New York Times that says he's been arrested in a prostitution sting.
Right.
I couldn't even believe it. I thought it said he had arrested somebody in a prostitution sting. And I wondered why the governor would be involved in that.
Right, because he used to be attorney general and he was going around, you know, busting prostitution rings. No, that was one of the most shocking days. I mean, we knew that it was a little bit rough with Eliot as governor, but people really liked him. In fact, confession here, I was offered a job in the Spitzer administration and I actually thought about it for 6 whole seconds, which is the longest I've ever thought about leaving journalism. And then I was like, nah.
What do they want you to do, communications?
Yeah, it was like one of the agencies, yeah, communications. But I did think about it for like 6 whole seconds, which I guess shows that, you know, everybody thought well of him and just did not expect that he would, you know, really do something that reckless to ruin his career like that. And then seeing David Paterson being elected was pretty exciting, his first African-American governor. So it was like quite an amazing time, but he certainly struggled a lot with that job. There were a lot of crazy things that happened during the Paterson administration.
Including walking off the dais after accepting, you know, the governorship and going to the tabloids and immediately admitting to extramarital affairs and drug use and all sorts of things.
Right. That was his first press conference.
Yeah, right.
Yep, we went to it wondering what he would say. And I guess he just wanted to get that all out of the way so it wasn't in the tabloids. That was one of those nights that I woke up at 3 a.m. and said, did that really happen? There's just been a lot of dramatic, very dramatic days that it just fun to be a part of.
No question.
And it's democracy. As messy and crazy as it is, it's democracy.
Absolutely. And that fourth estate, as we mentioned briefly in the beginning, is part of it. I mean, if we don't have the antiseptic, the light, the journalism covering the politics, then we're not doing our jobs as part of what the Bill of Rights seems to consider as part of a democracy.
That's right. That's right. But we do have to have the access, and we don't really have it in the same way. So it gets a little bit harder, it seems, every decade that goes along.
You're so right, because of the idea that they can go around us now. Submit your questions by email. I mean, none of this stuff would happen in the past. They didn't have the internet to bypass us. They had to do the interview or either not respond or say no comment.
Well, they have their social media feeds, they have their YouTube channels, and they can just go directly without having to answer pesky questions about, wait a minute, one and one does not equal two, like you're saying, you know, there's something wrong here. And politicians are avoiding us a lot lately, especially at the Capitol right now with the atmosphere. And it may be because it's all Democrats in power right now, Senate, Assembly, and the governor. And so you don't have an opposition party controlling any of those three branches of government to speak up. I mean, the Senate Republicans and Assembly Republicans, God bless them, they do speak up a lot, but we know that they don't have the votes to get anything done, so you can't really use them as a foil or to illuminate what might be a fault in some of the policies that the others are proposing.
That was the Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt. Congratulations, Karen. You can hear our entire conversation on this week's Capital Connection program at wamc.org. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. As the session nears its end, Republican state lawmakers and advocates for New York municipalities rallied at the Capitol this week to support rural communities. The Legislative Gazette's Lucas Willard was there and filed this report.
The state legislative session in Albany is scheduled to conclude next week. In the final days of the session, Republican State Assembly member Robert Smullen of the Mohawk Valley and Adirondacks convened a press conference to advocate for rural communities.
Our citizens deserve a fair share of attention and the resources that come from New York State to ensure that our families, our communities, and our businesses get what they deserve from their state government.
Before the start of the session in January, Smullen organized several community forums focused on rural equity and is supporting a slate of legislation that includes emergency services, energy, broadband access, and transportation. In a state of more than 19 million people, the lawmakers said more than 4 million New Yorkers live in rural areas. Joining the lawmakers was Executive Director of the New York State Association of Towns and outgoing Republican Glenville Town Supervisor Chris Ketsley. Ketsley spoke in support of Smullen's legislation to create a Rural Equity Assistance Program. The bill would help local governments access state funding and grant programs.
A lot of people forget how much time and effort it takes to administer grants. So this program would help communities that don't have the time, the resources, or the money to make those investments to better their communities. So we're very, very supportive of this legislation.
Republican assembly members joined in to advocate for their bills written to benefit rural communities. As the lawmakers spoke on the million-dollar staircase, a rally against Israel's war against Hamas in Gaza boomed from a floor above. Matt Simpson, a former Horicon town supervisor who represents the 114th Assembly District in the Adirondacks, promoted home heating legislation that would exempt wood burning from any restrictions under the state's 2019 law known as the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act.
Remember when we were all called crazy for calling out the CLCPA proposals aimed at banning gas stoves? Sure, the stoves weren't ripped from our homes, but that very ban was put on the books last year, and they will begin being phased out soon. It's only a matter of time. Don't think we forgot about the call to ban wood-burning heat sources upstate either.
As part of meeting New York's climate goals, school districts have until 2035 to convert their school bus fleets to electric vehicles. Republicans want to pump the brakes on that implementation. They point to statistics from the fiscal conservative think tank, the Empire Center for Public Policy, that say the cost to convert all school buses in New York could be more than $8 billion, far short of the available state and federal funding for districts. 132nd District Assembly member Phil Palmisano of the Southern Tier and Finger Lakes region said the state mandate on school districts is hypocritical.
Do you know what the timeline is for the state of New York to convert their heavy-duty and medium fleet? 2040. So we're asking our school districts to take on this experiment and complete a full transition, a full 5 years before the state of New York has to do so. That screams of hypocrisy. Oh, and by the way, the state of New York has an out if it's not feasible to do so. Our school districts do not have that luxury.
Republican Joe Angelino of the Southern Tier co-sponsors a bill with Palmisano that would extend more tax relief to volunteer firefighters and EMS. Angelino said rural emergency departments are disappearing due to lack of volunteers. Brisbane, in Angelino's 121st district, was forced to disband its volunteer fire department on January 1st. Angelino supports a $2,500 tax credit for all volunteer firefighters in good standing.
If we don't start attracting new members to our volunteer departments, we could look at facing a bill that would be in the billions of dollars for similar service. Right now, in my heart, I believe the last volunteer fireman has been born.
It is unclear what Republican priorities will pass before the session concludes. Democrats hold supermajorities in both houses of the state legislature. A spokesperson for Assembly Speaker Carl Hastie did not respond to a request for comment.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Lucas Willard.
Communities across the region are trying to create more affordable housing. The town of Plattsburgh recently hosted a housing symposium to review the challenges and potential solutions for the region. The Legislative Gazette's Pat Bradley reports.
A diverse group of stakeholders from six counties traveled to Plattsburgh to discuss housing challenges their communities face. The town of Plattsburgh hosted the gathering. Democratic Supervisor Michael Cashman said from escalating rent to a shortage of affordable options, the housing crisis touches every community across the region.
We've witnessed a staggering surge in the median rent, outpacing the growth in household income, and the disparity that it places an immense strain on families. This is not just a housing crisis. It is a multi-generational challenge which demands our collective attention and action.
The Lake Champlain Lake George Regional Planning Board is a community and economic development organization for Warren, Washington, Clinton, Essex, and Hamilton counties. Executive Director Beth Gillis explained that during the pandemic, they received funding to do an economic resiliency plan. Gillis said their study determined six key housing issues.
We've had dramatic increases in the housing price in the last few years. We've had growth in short-term rentals in specific communities that have pushed residents out. We've had a really low production of housing, only 0.1% increase in housing production in the last decade in the region. We've had an increase in seasonal housing. We have labor shortages that are actually contributing to the lack of housing production. And we have a mismatch in the regional wages.
At the completion of the study, Gillis described some of the strategies they recommended to help address the housing crisis.
So our number one was to support and grow the capacity of existing housing organizations. Sustainable funding for county land banks. I was very glad to see that in the New York State budget, we're also putting together a zoning guide, a best practices guide for communities to look at and maybe update their zoning.
RE/MAX North Country Associate Real Estate Broker Kira Witherwax has been talking with the town of Plattsburgh about the shortfall and said a multifaceted approach is needed to address the supply and affordability of housing.
Housing supply with new construction is where we can make a really big difference long term. We certainly have very immediate challenges with housing, but I do think it's important that we don't just focus on what's right in front of us this minute, because these are symptoms of a very old problem. So we need to not just look at what we have to do right now. It's important that we come up with short-term solutions and also long-term solutions so we don't end up in the same situation or worse in 10 to 20 years.
The Advocacy and Resource Center serves those with intellectual and developmental disabilities in Clinton County. Executive Director Robin Pierce told attendees of the forum that they are funded through Medicaid, and the more than 700 staff in the North Country deserve higher salaries.
Even though our starting rate of pay is $17 an hour, the work we do deserves to be closer to $25 an hour, but we can't afford to do that. And because of that, our staff have to work second jobs or overtime just to make ends meet. I share that because one of the things that the ARC is looking at is some strategic planning. And what came out of the strategic planning is we need to do something to help our staff with housing. We need to do something to help our staff with food as well.
The forum looked at a number of options, including workforce housing, mobile homes, tiny homes, buyer grants, and mixed income development that could be implemented in towns, villages, and cities across the North Country.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Pat Bradley.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. This week, I sat down with Kevin Owens, president and CEO of NYSTEC, New York State Technology Enterprise Corporation, a self-described independent nonprofit technology consulting company headquartered in Rome, New York, with offices in Albany and New York City. It was created in 1996 to facilitate the transfer of technology, innovation, and expertise between the public and private sectors in support of economic development across the state. NYSTEC will host its 7th annual Population Health Innovation Summit, a free public event at the Albany Capital Center, June 6, 2024. I began by asking Kevin what people can expect.
Population health and, you know, the experts we have coming, they really kind of study and focus to improve the health outcomes of groups of people by looking at the social and environmental determinants of health, as well as the policies, programs, and interventions that link all of that together. So we look to bring experts across the field who are working, perhaps maybe they're working on a smaller project at this point. Some of them are county-based, some of them are regionally-based, some of them are state-based, and some obviously have national exposure. But we look to provide those opportunities for presenters themselves, as well as the participants, to kind of have that epiphany of, oh, that's a great program. Is this possible that I could utilize this? Is it scalable that I could bring it back to my community? Can I make that connection with this expert and learn more about it? So again, I can bring this back into my care setting or my community as a provider or a healthcare provider. We found over the last 7 years that, you know, as we've grown, bringing all these experts together really provides a benefit. And also as a nonprofit consulting firm, I feel like it's my responsibility to kind of bring these pieces of information back to the community as part of my role of being a nonprofit consulting firm.
I don't know how you might answer this question, but obviously we're seeing right now this issue of staffing levels in hospitals and the idea of patients not getting the quality care because of that. We're even seeing strikes among nursing unions because of that in certain areas. But the idea that AI might be able to assist where it might have taken more nurses in the past, is that something that's possible? For example, I have an app on my phone with all my health records now, and so whenever I get a blood test, it's right there. I don't have to call and find out what my results are. It immediately appears on my phone.
Yes. I think the evolution of information that's available in healthcare has really been able to hopefully improve outcomes and also provide more access to patients and doctors to kind of leverage that information more quickly and more efficiently. I think in my history at NYSTEC, I started with them 14 years ago, and kind of the first set of projects I was responsible for was really kind of incentivizing providers and hospitals to get data into electronic health records. And eventually, you know, we reached a critical mass, I'd say. You know, I think most providers and hospitals are using electronic health records right now. But then it was like, how do we share the data? Now that my doctor has it, how can I share it with another doctor if you as a patient present someplace else? So then we made some progress in that, like sharing across care settings. But then now that you have all this data, it's how do you leverage it? Obviously, you have concerns about security and eliminating bias across healthcare data, but it does really provide opportunities now that we have such large data sets to really analyze those and to think of what are the best next steps in scenarios like this. It provides opportunities for doctors to identify trends that they may not have been able to identify before, because the data would have been in files across hospitals, across provider offices. And now you can kind of look at it and say, like, oh, there's a problem here. Maybe I can intercede or intervene a little bit quicker than I would have been able to before, because I may not have been able to recognize it before. It would have taken months, if not years, to recognize trends in some instances.
So who do you hoping will show up?
You know, I really hope it's people who are obviously interested in population health. I think it's a really important topic that people are spending a lot of time thinking about right now. I mean, healthcare in general, you know, healthcare costs, are skyrocketing, and making sure that everybody has access to healthcare is incredibly important. So we're looking for, I would say, individuals from government, state, local, perhaps federal, to kind of look for those individuals to become interested in some of these, as I said, perhaps some of these solutions that are being discussed by these presenters and how they can be leveraged more in the communities. We're also looking for our peers, other consulting groups, other clients that, again, can come and hopefully learn and make connections. And as I said, just continue to kind of improve our approach to population health. And, you know, I'm 57, so I'm heading towards my years where I may need more healthcare. And it's good to know that people are focusing on always improving that and making it a better experience for the patient.
Well, and you have quite a varied group and panels put together for different discussions. I'm looking at one, creating a culture of responsible AI solutions. This is a panel discussion that will take place, but an interesting guest. Now, I see Josh Klemm, Chief Information Officer for the New York State Thruway Authority. Might not be something people immediately think of as a person that would be on a discussion like this. How come?
Well, there's so many aspects to healthcare. I think people think of healthcare as just, I'm going to visit my doctor. But when we think about healthcare, there's so many inputs to a healthy individual. So you can think of access to housing as a facet of healthcare. You can think of public safety as a facet of healthcare. You can think of access to effective and safe transportation as a mode of getting better healthcare. So it really is kind of looking at holistically of all the services that are an input to a New Yorker, in this case, having a better life. And that really all intervenes with healthcare.
That's Kevin Owens, President and CEO of NYSTEC. The 7th Annual Population Health Innovation Summit runs from 8:15 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. Thursday, June 6th. Registration is open and is a free in-person public event. And that about does it for this week's show. The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. We had help from the New York Public News Network. You can listen to the Legislative Gazette anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. Look for program number 2422. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina. Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.